Hey, this is John Lee Dumas from EO Fire, and you're listening to Elective Rotation with Pharmacy Joe. You must be prepared to ignite.
What's up, Pharmacy Nation? I'm Pharmacy Joe. Thank you for listening to the Elective Rotation, a critical care pharmacy podcast. This is episode 35. In this episode, I'll review an article on propofol-related infusion syndrome, answer a drug information question about surgical antibiotic prophylaxis, and share a great resource I use for drug-induced thrombocytopenia. I have all the evidence supporting today's show linked up in the show notes at pharmacyjoe.com/episode35. If you know someone who would find this podcast helpful, please share it with them. Before we get to the topics for today's show, I want to let you know about the Pharmacy Nation Slack group. This is a free group with other pharmacists from around the world collaborating with each other using real-time messaging to help better care for patients. I hope you join me and the other Pharmacy Nation members there. We are fast approaching 100 pharmacists in the group. You can sign up at pharmacynation.org. The article I want to talk about today is titled Propofol Infusion Syndrome, a Structured Review of Experimental Studies and 153 Published Case Reports. The lead author, I hope I pronounced this right, is Adela Krajkova, and the article was published in Critical Care on November 12, 2015. Now, the background for the article talks about how propofol is one of the more popular medications for continuous sedation in the intensive care setting. And propofol, along with dexmedetomidine, are preferred over benzodiazepines in mechanically ventilated ICU patients, according to the Society of Critical Care Medicine's Pain, Agitation, and Delirium Guidelines. This is a Class 2B recommendation based on the strength of the evidence available at the time those guidelines were published. And I do have those guidelines linked up in the show notes. I'd really invite you to check them out. I consider those required reading for residents that take my rotation. So propofol has an uncommon but potentially deadly side effect referred to as propofol infusion syndrome, or PRIS. Now, there is not widespread agreement on a definition of PRIS, but most cases include several of the following: unexplained metabolic acidosis, rhabdomyolysis, hyperkalemia, hepatomegaly, renal failure, hyperlipidemia, arrhythmia, a Brugada-type ECG, which is an elevated ST segment and coved T waves, and rapidly progressive cardiac failure. The first cases were described in pediatric patients in the early 1990s, and these were followed very shortly by adult case reports. Now, the methods for the article were an analysis of 153 patient case reports and case series that were published between 1990 and 2014. The authors used multiple regression analysis to analyze the factors associated with fatal outcome of PRIS. The primary purpose of the study was to determine the relationship of propofol exposure in patients identified with PRIS. Secondary outcomes were to find a link between the clinical presentations of PRIS with proposed cellular mechanisms and to describe trends in the reporting of PRIS over time. The results the authors described included the fatality rate among the 153 published cases of 51%. Interestingly, this rate decreased over time from 74% of those cases published before 2001 to 64% between 2001 and 2006, all the way down to 32% mortality rate for cases published between 2006 and 2014. Interestingly, arrhythmia, other ECG changes, hypertriglyceridemia, and fever were all reported with decreasing frequency over time. Metabolic acidosis was the most common symptom of PRIS, with a constant incidence of about 3/4 of reported cases. Rhabdomyolysis and hypertriglyceridemia became more frequent after 96 hours of propofol use, whereas metabolic acidosis was more frequent in cases reporting a shorter duration of propofol administration before the development of PRIS. The author's multivariate analysis shows that after adjustment for covariates, there are only a few independent predictors of death from propofol-related infusion syndrome. The cumulative dose of propofol, as represented by both the mean infusion rate and the duration of infusion, the presence of traumatic brain injury, and fever were significantly related to mortality from PRIS. The authors made the following 4 associations. Number 1, dose-related signs of PRIS occur more frequently with higher infusion rates, irrespective of the duration of infusion. This includes cardiac failure, metabolic acidosis, fever, and perhaps hypotension. Of note, the first two tended to be more frequent in cases caused by a shorter duration of propofol infusion. So that was cardiac failure and metabolic acidosis were more frequent in cases caused by a shorter duration of propofol infusion. The second association the authors describe is signs of PRIS dependent on duration of infusion occur more frequently with longer propofol infusions, irrespective of the dose. And that's arrhythmia and other ECG changes belonging to that category. They occurred more frequently in cases where a whole range of propofol doses were administered for more than 48 hours. Association number 3 that the authors found, signs of PRIS dependent on cumulative dose rise in frequency with both the dose and time of administration. Rhabdomyolysis and hypertriglyceridemia, triglyceridemia represent this category, and occur most frequently with high doses of propofol after 96 hours of administration. And the last association they made was idiosyncratic signs of PRIS occur independently of the rate and duration of infusion. No kidding. Acute kidney injury and hepatomegaly belong to this category, even though hepatomegaly shows a trend to association with the cumulative dose. Now, the exact mechanism of PRIS is not known. There are 2 theories proposed. The authors of the study really go into detail, and the journal it's published in is an open access journal. So if you're interested in the fine detail of these possible theories, I really invite you to check out the article. Again, you can find it linked up in the show notes at pharmacyjoe.com/episode35. But in brief, the 2 mechanisms involve uncoupling of the respiratory chain in the mitochondria. So the first mechanism is that propofol is structurally similar to coenzyme Q10. And because of this, perhaps it gets into the mitochondria, gums up the works, and uncouples or inhibits the respiratory chain there. And the second is that propofol interferes with fatty acid oxidation, which also can uncouple the respiratory chain in the mitochondria. What I take away from this article is that among the published cases, exceeding maximum doses of propofol is both the main risk factor for the development of PRIS and increases the chance that PRIS will be fatal when it occurs. Some sedatives that we use, like fentanyl and midazolam, have what I like to call pretend maximum infusion rates. So we set our maximum infusion rate for midazolam at 20 milligrams an hour and fentanyl at 300 mics per hour, but we'll exceed those maximums on a case-by-case basis. For propofol, though, we do not exceed our institutional maximum of 50 mics per kilo per minute, which is actually about 3 milligrams per kilo per hour, lower than the 4 milligrams per kilo per hour suggested in FDA warnings and in this article. And the data from these published case reports really support that. So the drug information question is, should a patient already on antibiotics also be given antibiotics prior to incision before surgery? This question comes up quite a bit in various procedure areas and even occasionally the OR. And the answer is yes. Now, the ASHP surgical guidelines titled Clinical Practice Guidelines for Antimicrobial Prophylaxis in Surgery answer this very nicely on page 10. The guidelines are linked up in the show notes. And the guidelines state, patients receiving therapeutic antimicrobials for a remote infection before surgery should also be given antimicrobial prophylaxis before surgery to ensure adequate serum and tissue levels of antimicrobials with activity against likely pathogens for the duration of the operation. If the agents used therapeutically are appropriate for surgical prophylaxis, administering an extra dose within 60 minutes before surgical incision is sufficient. Otherwise, the antimicrobial prophylaxis recommended for the planned procedure should be used. For patients with indwelling tubes or drains, consideration may be given to using prophylactic agents active against pathogens found in these devices before the procedure, even though therapeutic treatment for pathogens in drains is not indicated at other times. For patients with chronic renal failure receiving vancomycin, a preoperative dose of cefazolin should be considered instead of an extra dose of vanco, particularly if the probable pathogens associated with the procedure are gram-negative. In most circumstances, elective surgery should be postponed when the patient has an infection at a remote site. Now, I hope this helps you in case you are asked the question in the future. And perhaps if someone asks you the question, you can just direct them to the show notes, pharmacyjoe.com/episode35. And last, the resource I'd like to share with you, I have it linked up in the show notes. The link is just too complicated to read out on the podcast, but the resource is titled Platelets on the Web. And this is my go-to website for evaluating drug-induced thrombocytopenia. Now, the website provides perspective about current information on a whole host of items related to thrombocytopenia. I have an extensive list in the show notes. It includes drug-induced thrombocytopenia, low platelet counts that occur during pregnancy, other disorders with low platelet counts associated with them, hemolytic uremic syndrome, complement-mediated thrombotic microangiopathy, but the biggest use I have for this website are the three databases listed on their front page. Now, the databases, all searchable by drug name, are first, a summary of all single case reports of drug-induced thrombocytopenia, a summary of all group case reports of drug-induced thrombocytopenia, and last, a database of drug-dependent platelet-reactive antibody testing at the Blood Center of Wisconsin. So definitely check out this resource and keep it in mind the next time you are looking for a medication-related cause of thrombocytopenia. I'm putting together a course on how to start a medical podcast so that other medical professionals can bring their knowledge, expertise, and voice to the world of podcasting. To learn more about the course and to sign up to be notified when it's available, head over to howtostartamedicalpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you in the next episode of the Elective Rotation.